Good morning. It's Monday morning and time again for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Patricia Kohlberg and I will be your host this morning. Today, true to our name, we take on a variety of issues. Luisa Martinez will continue her discussion with Mitch Green about heterodox economics. Book Mole Larry Bolden will take us back to the time of the Wobblies in his review of Jess Walter's latest novel. And we'll close our show with Bill Resnick and Wael Asadi discussing the assault on Palestine and how that situation is evolving politically. In solidarity with the Palestinians, our music today will be a selection of Palestinian protest songs. Tomorrow marks the one-year anniversary of the murder of George Floyd. To celebrate his life and legacy, two events are scheduled for tomorrow in solidarity with Black Lives Matter. A one-year vigil will be held from noon to 2 p.m. at the corner of North Rosa Parks and Denver. Then at 4 p.m., a rally and march will be held at Revolution Hall. Please come out for these events if you can. To begin our show this morning, Bill Resnick speaks with Shannon Osaka, an environmental activist who has co-authored a book about climate tipping points, those moments in the rise of global temperature at which feedback loops are precipitated, which are both unstoppable and accelerate the pace of global warming. They also take up the issue of social tipping points, that point at which the public demand for action on the climate becomes an unstoppable force. Here's Bill with more.
Shannon Osaka, welcome to KABU.
Thanks for having me.
Shannon Osaka is an environmental journalist with the web magazine Grist. She specializes in climate change. She just co-authored what amounts to an important report titled Points of No Return. The authors describe this report as, I quote, addressing climate change, but of a particular kind. Climate tipping points, elements of the Earth system in which small changes in global temperature can kick off reinforcing loops that tip a system into a profoundly different state, accelerating heat waves and permafrost thaw and coastal flooding and fueling more warming. To give us some examples of those Earth systems in which what look like small changes can kick off these major reinforcing loops that would really accelerate global warming.
Yeah, so one of the first ones that I think of is if we think about the Greenland ice sheet, which is just this huge, enormous ice sheet, and that ice sheet has started to melt. And what happens when it starts to melt is you would think, okay, as the temperature goes up, it melts a certain amount with each increase in temperature. That may not actually be the case, because what happens is that as the ice sheet melts, there are these various feedbacks that start to play in that cause it to melt faster and faster. One thing is it melts, and then that reduces the bright white snow that's on top of the ice sheet, and that white snow reflects the sunlight. And when it gets darker, then it absorbs more sunlight, and that causes more melting, which in turn causes less snow, which causes more melting. You can see where it goes from there. Another interesting sort of tipping point and feedback loop is permafrost. So permafrost is this Arctic soil that is basically frozen. Normally, it's frozen all year round, and it holds all of these little microbes and things like that that are not decaying at the normal speed. What happens is as we are heating up the planet, that permafrost is starting to melt. And what that means is that all of these little materials which have been held in there and which include a ton of methane emissions, as they melt, that methane goes into the atmosphere. And methane is an extremely powerful greenhouse gas. It's about 84 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. And having that methane in the atmosphere can then create more warming, which then creates more melting of the permafrost, more melting of the Greenland ice sheet. You can sort of see how things start to spiral a little bit out of control.
Yeah, the melting of the permafrost, my sense is that permafrost is not just microbes and very small bacteria and things, but also the top part of the permafrost right near the surface. In the summer, there are some small plants that thrive there, some flowers. There are insects, sometimes so many insects that human beings can't tolerate them. They all die very soon, and they build up this layer of almost always frozen permafrost. I've read, actually, that it's a huge, huge volume of what becomes carbon dioxide or methane as it decays.
Right.
A huge volume, much more than, the volume in the atmosphere.
Right, exactly. It's enormous. I mean, sort of the good news is that the melting could take place over a very long period of time. But already we're seeing that the area of permafrost has started to lose more carbon than it sucks up. And so that's causing, I think it's about 300 to 600 million tons of carbon released every year. And so that's a really significant addition to the carbon emissions that we are already spewing into the atmosphere all the time.
The same thing, it seems to me, is happening in other areas, bands of plants and animals around the globe as they warm, like the boreal forests or tropical forests. It's a similar process. All of the carbon that's stored in the ground, especially, but in the trees themselves, when the trees die, and the below ground processes get warmer, you get a tremendous release then as it decays of carbon dioxide and methane.
Yeah, in the Amazon rainforest is just this enormous stockpile of carbon, right? I mean, because any living creature, any tree is basically storing tons of carbon in its bark and its tissues. And what's happening is, as temperatures go up, as certain areas are getting hotter and drier, that's increasing the dry season, that's making the rainforest more likely to burn. And what happens is when trees burn, they release that carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And so the rainforest has for a long time been a carbon sink, meaning it's sucking CO2 out of the atmosphere and storing it in those trees. And over time, we're now seeing it that it could actually become a source of carbon emissions by about 2035, where it's giving off more than it's taking up. And that, again, has very significant impacts on long-term climate change.
You know, one of the things in your report that I found most interesting was the description of the tropical forests and how they, in fact, there's mechanisms that maintain themselves. They're just not sort of growing there. And if you interrupt those mechanisms that they maintain, like transpiration that keeps things both cold and wet over huge areas of land, when you begin undermining those natural processes, destruction of the rainforest, the death of trees, and the death of whole areas of trees, not some ranching and farming, which is also being now accelerated in the rainforest under Brazil's Donald Trump. The whole rainforest ecosystem could, in fact, ultimately collapse. That would be just an enormous disaster for the world and probably wipe out humanity. And it's not inconceivable.
I don't want to go so far as to say that it might wipe out humanity, but it would be quite devastating, especially to the region and to the overall planet. I think the estimate is that if about a quarter of the rainforest is deforested, then that might turn the entire Amazon into essentially a savanna. And the reason that happens is because the trees themselves are creating this moist environment. They're sucking up water through their roots, and then they're transpiring it out through their leaves, and that creates rainfall. It produces sort of a cooling effect. And so the idea is that once you cut down trees, the ecosystem doesn't go back automatically to the way it was before. The trees are really creating this whole environment. And so it's really, it can be quite terrifying. One thing, when I was reporting on this story, what I kept thinking about just from a personal level, another part of it is we were looking at, you know, the destruction of coral reefs from ocean acidification. And I just kept thinking, I want to personally see these ecosystems because I don't know that they're going to be around in 10, 15, 20 years.
You know, my dire prediction, most dire prediction, that in fact humanity might in fact be stressed to the breaking point and in fact disappear, is that human beings don't just sit idly by and allow themselves to die and starve to death. What we'll get if global warming takes hold and begins destituting and destroying the environment around the world, especially in the hotter countries, which become uninhabitable, they're not going to sit down and just wait to die. And they have militaries, and some of them have hydrogen bombs and nuclear weapons. We're going to get some kind of a dystopia that Hollywood is so good at showing. What we can expect is nuclear blackmail. The Pakistanis could say, we're going to set off this machine that will bathe the entire planet in deadly neutrons unless you send us some food. And we are not responsible for what's happened to the globe. You are, which is absolutely true. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KVOO, on 90.7 Portland, Oregon, talking to Shannon Ozaka, an environmental journalist with the web magazine Grist. She specializes in climate change, just co-authored a substantial report titled Points of No Return. We've just discussed several of those tipping points that threaten to make global warming irreversible, and that's threatened to create temperatures that leave the plant virtually uninhabitable for humans. Fortunately, at this time, things are not hopeless. Climate scientists give us 10 years, not a very long time, to greatly reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And the good news is that we know what has to be done. We have the resources and the technologies, off-the-shelf technologies, to do it. For those of you out there in radio land who listen to KBOO and our Old Mole show, you've heard all about that raft of solutions and discussions of the Green New Deal and its many components. But for those solutions to be realized, we need a different set of tipping points, that is, social and political tipping points, such that the people wake up and demand a mobilization to save the planet. Shannon Ozaka, at the conclusion, the end of your report, you briefly discussed signs that those social and political tipping points might well be occurring. Let's conclude with your optimistic ideas about emerging politics.
Sure. I think it's interesting because I think there's that old adage, right, which is that change happens slowly and then all at once. Like you'll see this sort of microscopic step-by-step change happening over a period of decades, then all of a sudden, boom, everything looks totally different. And in the conclusion to the piece, I talk a little bit about basically in 10 years, there was a huge change in America from going from horses and pedestrians to there being 5 million cars on the road. Now, for climate change, that was ultimately not a very good change, but it shows how fast things can happen. So I think when we think about what we've called here and what a few researchers have called social tipping points, there's a few different things that we're talking about. One side of social tipping points can be technological, like, for example, particular types of energy becoming cheaper than other types of energy. So in most places, we've already started to see this. Solar and wind energy is now cheaper than fossil fuels in many, many markets across the world. And that's a big force behind the lowering of the U.S. carbon emissions over the past 12 years. So that's one thing, that's the technological side. And then there's the social side, and this is much harder to follow and track and understand from a research perspective, because what you see are these general social changes, and they're kind of hard to quantify. But in the past few years, I mean, here in the U.S., we've had the Sunrise Movement, which is a huge youth climate movement. There have been many other youth climate activist groups that are getting out there pushing for the Green New Deal and really changing the conversation. There's been Greta Thunberg in the European Union. She's been making a lot of noise and kind of pushing climate change into the mainstream. And so there's a growing number of things socially that are starting to make people feel like supporting action on climate change is the right moral thing to do. And also fossil fuels are starting to look really immoral. There's the movement to divest university endowments from fossil fuels and all of that kind of thing. So we've seen over the past few years sort of an awakening socially in the US and in other parts of the world. And I think the biggest question for me is, in the aftermath of the coronavirus, of the pandemic, when people are excited to get back out there and live their lives, will that activism continue?
My optimistic assessment is that it surely will. My pessimistic optimism is that COVID is not over and various variants may appear.
Very true.
Which will upset the apple cart of the entire system around the world. The unprecedented viral attack, which we've allowed to happen, thanks especially to the right-wing deniers. But if, in fact, we recover from the pandemic, my sense is that the future holds, and the climate scientists are unmistakably predicting that we are going to see a series of intensifying, damaging, dangerous climate events. You're going to see cities underwater, maybe Long Island underwater. Mar-a-Lago may be floating downstream, varies into the ocean. These terrible droughts, hurricanes, typhoons, they're already becoming more intense and more intense. And at some point, people are going to wake up. And it could be in the next 5 or 10 years, maybe 15 years. As long as climate change has not become irreversible, there are going to be moments when people are realizing the risks that they and their families and their children and families and their neighbors and everybody around the world, it will be an international awakening. And it's not inconceivable that the good guys will be able to take command of the economy. It would have to be a massive movement that would displace the elite class and be so big that the army didn't want to take them on. But in fact, we could have that wartime mobilization that some are talking about, all resources, every bit of capacity we had to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Anyway, that's my hope. Shannon Osaka, environmental journalist, written a lot on climate change. Look for her report on GRIST, Points of No Return. Thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thanks so much, Bill, for having me.
Freedom for Gaza, freedom for every child, mother and father, who are being bombed by the bombs of Obama. I'm bursting out tears while you're bursting out with laughter. Freedom for Palestine, freedom for Gaza, freedom for every child, mother and father, who are being bombed by the bombs of Obama. I'm bursting out tears while you're bursting out with laughter. Free Palestine and lay down your weapons. This is for the
That was from a song called Free Palestine by the rap artist Ambassador. Before the music, we heard Bill Resnick speaking with Shannon Osaka about climate change tipping points. Next on our show, Luisa Martinez continues her conversation with Dr. Mitch Green about heterodox economics, which takes a fresh and more humane look at how economies can and should operate. This, the second in a three-part series, takes up the issue of inflation and draws important distinctions between those who issue currency, like the federal government, and those who use it, like the rest of us. And somehow, Luisa and Mitch managed to make learning economics fun.
Hey, everybody. This is Luisa Martinez, and welcome to part two of our interview with heterodox economist Dr. Mitch Green. Mitch is a PhD economist living in Portland. He teaches classes at Portland Community College, and he also researches and works with issues related to energy economics as a research scholar for the Global Institute for Sustainable Prosperity. He's a first-generation college student, anti-imperialist army veteran, lover of dogs, and a parkour enthusiast. Last time we spoke, we talked about the summary between the two visions of economics, right? In mainstream economics, the economy is fundamentally scarce and finite. People are fundamentally self-interested. Markets are necessary to allocate those resources that are scarce and ensure that they're put to the best use. Alternatively, heterodox economics is a social provisioning process where key features of its organization are socially constructed, where resources are produced and not inherently scarce. And this is a far more open and discretionary view of how we structure society. So Mitch, thanks so much for joining us again.
Glad to be here again. I'm super stoked.
So last time we chatted, you made the claim that money is not scarce and can be created to mobilize resources. What would you say to somebody that is trying to purchase something right now, like for instance, lumber, and cannot because it's either on back order or the price is higher? So wouldn't we consider that inflation and shouldn't we be worried?
I'm glad you asked that. Like, that's a really valid concern because it's a practical experience that folks have, but it's really important to understand what's causing that issue at a fundamental level. It's not true that deficit spending to, say, get cash to households who need it during the COVID crisis is the cause of those supply chain problems. Rather, what we're seeing now across a range of goods are structural issues inherent in the nature of how those supply chains were constructed, which has been years in the making, which in a sense exposed their lack of resiliency.
Okay, so then can you talk about that a little bit? What do you mean by supply chain problems?
Yeah, so let's look at new cars, for instance. Automakers, firms have had a hard time sourcing some of the key components for an automobile, like semiconductors in particular, to finish new vehicles. And that's due to bottlenecks and constraints in those global supply chains. So what a supply chain is, for folks kind of new to that concept, is it's a representation of a series of discrete production stages that must occur to transform raw materials into finished goods, right? And so every good, every market has supply chains. And so it takes a lot of different steps to get like a semiconductor produced and then ultimately put into a Ford pickup truck. So sometimes there's a lack of investments in key stages, or corporations rely upon maybe a single supplier to furnish a key good. And that gums things up when there's a shock to the system, right? And so the same can be said for lumber. Prices are wild right now for things like plywood or 2x4s because of a decade of underinvestment in milling capacity and some other constraints that have nothing to do with the current crisis. So the business community baked into their long-term expectations the idea that growth was going to remain low in perpetuity following like a very weak and tepid response on a fiscal level to the Great Recession. Okay, remember, we were all very, very austerian during that period of time. So if anything, fiscal prudence itself, like fear of deficits itself, actually created the conditions for the specific supply chain problems we're seeing today.
Okay, so would you say perhaps recently the gas crisis that we see, maybe as a result of people pouring gasoline into trash bags?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know if that's the same. I mean, that was a situation where there was a hack on a pipeline and they got into the billing system and did a ransomware attack. But like the owners of that pipeline were more worried about how they were going to settle the accounts of those bills. They didn't know how much to bill basically during that period of time. So they just shut the whole pipeline down rather than like deal with like potentially underbilling someone. So that's a related problem. I mean, I would say that that's part of a broader issue when you leave the business of infrastructure up to the private sector to make decisions that affect our welfare as a whole. You get weird, absurd results like that. By the way, kids at home, don't put gasoline in a flimsy plastic bag. It's just going to dissolve through the gasoline, the plastic bag, and then you'll end up with that in your trunk.
While we're at it, I mean, don't put it in a plastic tub. Just don't pour it into large containers and then drive away from the gas station. Would you agree? Is that your professional opinion, Mitch?
Yeah, that's I was willing to stake my reputation on that before I got the PhD.
Oh, okay. That's noble. Okay. So back to the issue at hand, I think I see what you're saying. So what you just said doesn't change the fact that these things are in short supply today and that sustained deficit spending is only going to aggravate that, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a tricky problem, right? So you wouldn't want, because you have the conditions right now. So you wouldn't want the federal government to go out tomorrow and just try to outbid the market for resources that are presently hard to come by because of those supply chain problems. But even worse would be like for a retrenchment in the policies that have shored up people's household finances, like, for instance, like cutting unemployment insurance too early, or not pursuing some more bold things that you thought maybe we might do, like student loan forgiveness. Yeah, even though many of us might have been surprised that that was on the table, it seemed like there was a moment where they could actually pull that off from this administration. It would be far worse to like stop short now because you're scared of some early shoots that you think are inflationary, and then drain the private sector of incomes, because it's just going to exacerbate this very problem that got us into where we are today. So it's in a sense kicking the can down the road, and it leaves us back in a world where those low growth expectations were validated. Okay, basically what you need to do, if you put me in the seat right now, you need to convince investors that this boom is real. So they'll go out and they'll build more capacity, right? You need to convince them that growth will remain strong, demand will remain strong for the long haul, and they will invest in more capacity. And building capacity is actually the only way to make scarce resources less scarce.
Okay. Okay. So kind of related to taking the concept, you're kicking the can down the road. Working class people identify with how the national economy is framed in the mainstream media, right? So that when we pass budgets to pay for social services or what happens more often is tax cuts for rich people, that we're essentially putting it on a credit card, right? We're kicking the can down the road and we're borrowing against the future. And what you're saying is that heterodox economists argue that if something is technically possible, right? So we could, for instance, technically have the possibility of ending world hunger or stopping climate catastrophe, and we're at post-scarcity, then we can pay for it, right? So can you explain the difference for somebody just learning all this? Like, what is the difference between a personal budget, which is very narrow for the vast majority of people in this country, versus the discretion that's available at the federal level?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and it's a hard one to wrap your mind around, but at the first place you need to start is you have to ask yourself whether or not you are the issuer of a currency or whether you're the user of a currency. So all of us the working families, we all have the experience directly as users of the currency. So to pay our bills, we have to sort of go out into the world and somehow earn money in dollars, right? We have to get a job. If we're lucky, we've got some assets that have been gifted to us, maybe because like a wealthy uncle died or whatever. And so like we've got some sort of asset somewhere that brings dollars into our households. And to accumulate dollars over time and save for the future and manage our household budgets in a prudent way, we have to spend less than we bring in. So that's a fundamentally kind of like user of the currency constrained way to view things. But the federal government is completely different than that. It is the issuer of the currency, right? So in order for any of us to save in dollars or spend in dollars, we have to get it from somewhere. And the place that we get it from is the issuer of the currency, and that's the federal government. So in some sense, the federal government can never run out of dollars. Okay. It can always afford to pay its bills in dollars because at the end of the day, every last use of that dollar came from federal spending in the first place. So we have this situation where that distinction matters up front. And so there is there's this relationship when you add it all up and you add all the sector or all the households together, and you come up with a private sector balance, and then you compare that to the public sector balance. Those are sort of mirror images of each other. Okay.
And can I wait? I'm sorry. Could you explain the difference? What do you mean by public sector and private sector balance?
Yeah. So all of us, you and I, you know, folks who are having this conversation, we're worried about making sure we're saving for a rainy day. We are all users of the currency. We are all part of what we call the private sector. Okay. So private actors, just everyday people, make up what we call the private sector in the economy. And then there's another sector, which makes up the federal and state and local government section sectors. And so that's sort of like the public sector. Okay, so when you think about public sector versus private sector, when we think about financial balances, we are talking about which side of the ledger they are on. Okay, so if you look at the national debt, for instance, and you see it growing, you want to ask, well, who holds the asset and who holds the liability there? Okay, because there's always two sides of that coin. So, you know, a growing national debt is the same as a growing set of private sector savings. So there's a mirror relationship. It's hazardous to think about, private debt and public debt as not interconnected, because they are, but they're quite different. Okay. So I'll pause there and see if there's like any confusion that I can clear up there. I think that's a really hard one for my students to wrap their brains around, you know?
Yeah. Is there an analogy that you use that maybe clarifies things a little bit better? Or you just take points off? Is that your...
No, actually we do this thing. I don't always do it in my classes, but we used to do this thing where I went to graduate school, and PCC sometimes do it, where it's like a component of your grade is earning like Rubik. So if you're a PCC student, you might have like kangaroos, the mascot, right? So you might have to go out and earn what we're calling Rubik. And the only way to earn that is to go out and like maybe do some community service, or you maybe do a service learning project. And then you get credit in coalition with this like agency you worked with for those hours you worked. And then the only place you can get them though is from me, and I'm the treasurer. So I'm issuing these Rubik that satisfy your obligation to get them. And so in one sense, I'm generating money. We're going to call them Rubik. I am running a deficit against me. And the people who are my students collecting these Rubik to satisfy a part of their grade and in the process doing like socially useful work, they're collecting a surplus. Okay. And so that balances dollar for dollar. And that's like a way that kind of clicks for the students. It's also a way to like use quasi public institutions to actually get outside of this boundary that we've been talking about. So like, for instance, I've got some friends in upstate New York, who during early on in the COVID crisis tried to convince, the SUNY system to issue like this alternative currency called unis and like float this kind of like thing to kind of keep things going, and then have the Fed buy it up in a very complicated way. And it's all part of this like idea that there are layers of possibility here, but it starts by first recognizing that that there's a difference between a user and an issuer of a currency.
Okay, but at the end of the day, it's all a social relationship.
Correct. Right. And there's a hierarchy of acceptability. Like I could write an IOU to you, and you could choose whether or not you want to accept it for something that that you've given me and like as payment for a thing. But you may want to do that because maybe you heard that I'm like bad at paying my bills, you know? And so it's a question of acceptability and trust. And there's this like nexus of possibility there. But at the very top, whether we like it or not, stands the state. And everyone accepts the state's obligations for a broad set of reasons.
Okay. Well, thanks. I think we'll leave it there. And if you learned anything from this conversation, it's not to pour gasoline into buckets. Would you say that's right, Mitch?
I think that's the most critical lesson of our time.
Okay. Thanks so much. And we will be back next week with part three of our interview with Dr. Mitch.
Thank you.
കട്ടുന്നു ധീരരായി വഞ്ചകരാഞ്ചൂത കട്ടാളന്മാരോടായി കല്ലാലെ തീർക്കുന്നു ശൂരരായി വെടിയുണ്ട പീരങ്കി ചീറി വരുമ്പോൾ വിരുമാറ് കട്ടുന്നു ധീരരായി വഞ്ചകരാഞ്ചൂത കട്ടാളന്മാരോടായി കല്ലാലെ തീർക്കുന്നു ശൂരരായി ഇന്തിഫാദ 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 അവസാന ശ്വാസവും
That was a clip from a song called Intifada by singer Sidratul Muntaha. Before that, Luisa Martinez and Mitch Green discussed some of the ideas of heterodox economics. Now we turn to a review by Larry Bolden of a recently released novel called The Cold Millions by Pacific Northwest writer Jess Walter. The story takes up age-old questions of how to effect progressive social change that will sound very familiar to Old Mole listeners. As usual, during these COVID times, I will be reading Larry's review for him. What Jess Walter shows us in his 2020 novel, The Cold Millions, is that he is a wonderful storyteller, a fine historian, and, like one of his characters, guilty of first-degree aggravated empathy. This lovely historical novel is, on one hand, simply a story of the love between two brothers, Gig and Rye Dolan, who hop freight trains together, traveling from town to town and job to job. They are part of the cold millions, that is, the millions upon millions of workers who struggle day to day simply to live, while a few wealthy owners pursue lives of almost unfathomable wealth and luxury. While Walter is quick to inform us in his afterword that this is a book of fiction, he also makes it clear that some of his characters are based on real-life people, one of whom is the great labor organizer Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, a key character in the book. Gurley is a mesmerizing and powerful speaker and organizer. Even the skeptics listen when she speaks. Quote, "Listen, brothers and sisters, have we ever seen such trying times?" She went through a list of outrages, 15-hour workdays and women dying at their sewing machine, men crushed in cave-ins while their families got nothing, copper kings and shipping magnates living like royalty while poor workers couldn't even afford a flop bed, families in tents and hovels, workers given no rights and tossed aside when they were too broken or sick or old to work." End quote. Clearly, Walter shares the same sense of outrage expressed by Gurley. He tells us that his own father was a union man. Gig, the older brother, joins the IWW, although he discourages his brother Rye from getting involved. While Walter's sympathies are clearly with the so-called Wobblies, he carries on a kind of debate regarding the efficacy of their non-violent methods. One character, Early Reston, clearly thinks non-violent methods will not work, and that rather than piecemeal reform, the whole structure must be blown apart. At times in the book, both Gig and Ryan become disenchanted with the methods of the IWW. Quote, "Rye felt demoralized. It didn't matter what he did, what Gurley did, what Fred Moore did, what any of them did. Somewhere there was a roomful of wealthy old men where everything was decided. Beliefs and convictions, lives and livelihoods, right and wrong, these had no place in that room. The scurrying of ants at the feet of a few rich men. It made me think that Early Reston was right in his way, that maybe it was the castle that needed to be blown up." end quote. While it is clearly the struggles between owners and labor that is the focus of this novel, the side stories are also fascinating. The story of Ursula the Great, a performer who enters a cage with a full-grown cougar and then strips to near nudity as the crowd looks on, partly horrified, partly titillated. There is also a sweet tale of the budding love Rye feels for Gurley, although she is married and pregnant, and nothing comes of it. I much appreciated the argument Walter has with himself throughout the book regarding the possibility of real change and the methods that can achieve it. At one point, when Rye is called out as one of them wobblies by a salesman, quote, Rye didn't answer. But at that moment, he felt done with it all. Done with the beatings, done with Taft, done with Lem Brand and Ursula, done pretending they could stand on soapboxes and draw justice out of the air. Early was right. Rye didn't believe in anything but a job, a bed, some soup. End quote. If you read this novel, be sure to leave some good reading energy for the acknowledgments and the short closing essay by Walter, The Undercurrents of History. Walter talks of his own growing up in Spokane, Washington, and of how the world came to him in books. Quote, with the cold millions, I set out to write about the sort of working-class Spokane family in which I had grown up. My dad's father, a rancher named Jess Walter, first arrived in eastern Washington on a train he'd hopped as a vagrant field worker. My mother's dad, Ralph, was an itinerant laborer in the 1930s, who later died on a construction site when a crane fell on him. My own father, Alpha Bruce Walter, was a lifetime steelworker and union leader who worked almost 40 years in an aluminum rolling mill. End quote. For those readers who want to go to original historical sources, Walter provides an extensive list of his own sources in addition to his personal experience. For all who have labored and for all who feel keenly the injustices of the world, this is a must-read, and it is also a wonderful story. I've been talking about Jess Walter's novel, The Cold Millions. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour. And this is Patricia Kullberg pretending once again to be Larry Bolden. And for our final segment today, Bill Resnick returns with Palestinian activist Wael Asadi to talk about the latest developments in the decades-long subjugation of the Palestinians by the Israeli state.
Wael Asadi, welcome to Cable.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Wael Asadi, his family are refugees from Palestine. He's for many, many years an activist and leader in the Palestinian human rights and liberation movements in Portland. For the last several weeks, the Palestinian struggle for human rights and land and nation has again exploded in the occupied territories and Gaza, and now too within the Green Line of the state called Israel. We'll be discussing the long-term origins of the struggle, as well as the short-term triggers of the current uprising, which have to do with the leadership of both Israel and Palestine, long-time leaders, actually, but haven't been discredited, but they're seeking to hold onto power. We'll also discuss this country that for the last 70 years, it's been Israel's protector on the global scene, and that's supported by all American elites in both political parties. But recently, that has changed some, exemplified by the organization Human Rights Watch critiquing Israel for practicing apartheid. That could not even have been imagined 10 years ago. So first, Wael Asadi, tell us the origins of the continuous Palestinian struggle and the periodic uprisings.
Thank you for that question. I think that's a really important place to start, because the media and American politicians tend to have a memory that's about a week old with regards to the recent quote-unquote clashes. And what this is really about is ultimately a process of ethnic cleansing in which Palestinians since 1948 have been forced from their homes by Israelis, forced from their nation. In 1948, over 700,000 Palestinians were forced from their homes in what we call the Nakba, the Great Catastrophe for Palestinians, including my grandparents. And since that day, Israel as a colonial settler state has essentially continued along that project, forcing out another 300,000 Palestinians in 1967, and consequently continuing their expansion of settlers and dispossession of Palestinians, with periodic resistance from the Palestinians stretching back to 1936, to the First Intifada in the 80s, the Second Intifada in the 2000s, and most recently, of course, the continued ethnic cleansing by the State of Israel in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, which they have been for years now attempting to convert as part of the quote-unquote Judaization of Jerusalem, that is, to force the Palestinian residents out of Jerusalem and implant in their place Jewish Israeli settlers. And this is just the latest round of this long process of ethnic cleansing and colonization by the Israeli state of the Palestinian people. And of course, the continued resistance that we see of the Palestinians.
You know, what's so stunning to me is the lengths that they go to drive out Palestinians. They've basically been on a campaign for the entire period, actually, to undermine the Palestinian production and their economy and their capacity to live decent lives. They want to immiserate the Palestinian people. The settlers in the West Bank are constantly uprooting olive trees, burning fields, threatening people, sometimes killing farmers. They have impunity. This is Cable Radio 90.7 at Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick talking to Portland Palestinian leader and activist Wael Al-Saadi. We just discussed the long-term origin of the Palestinian struggle. As to the short-term, however, the trigger of the current uprising, most observers in this country, including on the left, see it as a result of a struggle for power within both nations, Palestine and Israel. And in this analysis, in both countries, a seemingly permanent leadership of Netanyahu, who's been there for a long time, as well as Abbas in the West Bank, and Hamas in Gaza, they've all been discredited, but they seek to maintain power. Well, what do you make of that explanation?
Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that, but I think we have to place it in context in terms of what the immediate trigger is. The first place we have to look at is in terms of the Netanyahu administration, which is a deeply corrupt administration. Netanyahu is facing corruption charges, and of course, as long as he stays as the prime minister, he can't be prosecuted. So this is a situation in which he has not only political reason to stay in power, but also personal stake here to avoid jail, which is a lot of what Israeli leftist commentators attribute, to some extent at least, to this latest escalation. Netanyahu was facing the potential of a unity coalition government that included some elements of the center and the right, and part of these escalations have helped, again, to polarize the situations and to attempt to project him as the protector of the Israeli people, and to also disunite his coalition. So the right-wing Yamina party, which was in potential talks with the coalition government to replace the Netanyahu government, has pulled back since the escalation and the attacks on Gaza. So the onus for the immediate trigger is on the Netanyahu government, which supported and has been escalating the eviction in Sheikh Jarrah, and the settler movement and the right-wing settler movement is a huge ally of the Netanyahu administration, as well as their attacks on Gaza have also been a way to draw attention away from a massive intifada and a resistance that emerged on the ground in the West Bank, and to, again, be able to trot out the line that Israel is in danger from Hamas's rockets. So that's a part of it. Of course, the Israeli state is daily oppressing the Palestinians, the people in Gaza, the people in West Bank, and so on. So this is part and parcel to some extent of the results of that daily oppression and their so-called policy of mowing the grass in Gaza, where they go in and blow up buildings and kill civilians from time to time to maintain control. So that's a part of the immediate trigger. The other part is that for Palestinians now, the Palestinian Authority has, with Mahmoud Abbas of the Fatah Party, has been president without election since 2006 in the West Bank. Mahmoud Abbas, of course, is a deeply unpopular figure among Palestinians who's seen as thoroughly corrupt, and in fact that the PA is an indigenous arm, an extension of the Israeli occupation that oftentimes will even attack Palestinian protesters, has continued their security coordination with the state of Israel, and has led the Palestinian people towards a dead end. We're coming almost to the 30-year mark now of the Oslo peace process, and yet the, of course, rather than an independent state, the Palestinians face a deepening entrenching of Israeli apartheid, ethnic cleansing, as we see in Sheikh Jarrah and other places. So there was deep disillusion with Mahmoud Abbas and the PA. And then the Hamas movement has certainly not capitulated to Israel the way that the Palestinian Authority is. They are also seen as ineffective, at minimum, in terms of winning liberation for the Palestinians. They've governed Gaza now for over a decade, and Gaza has continued to be isolated, blockaded, and Hamas's regional allies have really lost momentum in the region as a result of the overturning and counter-revolution in the Arab Spring. So their political star has also declined, and they're seen as authoritarian by many in the Gaza Strip as well. So there was a deep well of anger. There's a whole generation of young people. If you're 20 years old today, those 20-year-olds have lived under nothing but a complete failure of the so-called peace process, a political leadership that is completely defunct and incapable, and oftentimes seeing as being in cahoots with Israel, and massive unemployment, harassment by Israeli soldiers at checkpoints, and humiliation. And this is at the roots of the massive resistance that has emerged. And this was a miscalculation, I think, by Netanyahu. I don't think he expected the amount of resistance that emerged among the Palestinian people.
This is Bill Resnick talking to Wael Osadi, a Palestinian activist here in Portland. Since shortly after the creation of Israel in 1948, the U.S. has strongly supported Israel, using it as a forward military base in the Middle East, giving it several billion dollars per year. I think now it's $3.8 billion to make Israel one of the major militaries on this planet. And this unconditional support for Israel was, for the most part, unconditionally supported by the great majority of U.S. North Americans. This appears to have changed, exemplified by the Human Rights Watch critiquing Israel for practicing apartheid, which is a powerful, powerful critique. They could have said much less and been surprising. The elites of Israel are now very worried that their complete domination of Palestinians, their program of destroying the Palestinian nation, of erasing it, actually, just not from the world today, but from history, it's losing support, especially among young people all over the world. And here, what's your sense of things, and what do you think can be accomplished here to advance the cause of a just and democratic Palestine-Israel?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for years now, Israel has attempted to cover what is a process of apartheid and ethnic cleansing with nothing more than kind of marketing slogans and myths. And that is starting to crumble, first and foremost, because of the years of steadfastness, resistance of the Palestinian people, and the huge unity that they're showing today in coming out not only in the West Bank and Gaza, but also inside of the 1948 line. Those Palestinian citizens of Israel who make up 20% are showing how big of a lie it is that Israel is a democracy, right? So that's a part of it, and that has eroded the image of Israel over the years. Another part of that is, of course, that accelerated this was the fact that the Netanyahu administration hitched its wagon to a deeply unpopular and racist Trump administration, which made it much easier to actually make Palestine a partisan issue. Trump was deeply unpopular, seen as racist, and was a fierce supporter of the Israeli state and its most right-wing policies. And it became much easier for Palestinian solidarity activists here in the United States to actually make the argument that this is a racist apartheid state that should be opposed. And of course, the years of work by activists in the boycott, sanctions, and divestment movement has helped sow the grounds. We've been talking and documenting how Israel is an apartheid state for years. And that set the ground when this political shift finally happened for that narrative to be there for groups like Human Rights Watch to take it and to be able to finally express that and have it be seen much more among a mainstream audience that this is actually what is happening. And that's also been helped by a left-wing current inside Congress that we've never had in this country before, of course, led by AOC, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, and Bernie Sanders, who are able to, for the first time, be able to voice disagreement with the U.S.'s blanket support for the state of Israel. And that's incredibly important because for the first time, we have a situation in which the question of ending U.S. military aid to Israel, which is fundamental to Israel's capacity to be able to continue to oppress the Palestinian people, the military aid, and of course the political support of the United States, is actually coming into question, and not only among activist circles, but in the halls of Congress. And that's a very important step forward. And I think we're not at the point yet where we can end that, but we have made a huge crack, and I think we can make incredible progress in that way, because thanks to movements like the Black Lives Matter movement over the past decade, people are much more sensitive and willing to talk about racism, willing to talk about state-sanctioned violence, and they're making those connections to the question of Palestine.
Well, El-Sadi, we'll be talking about this in the future, particularly about what us U.S. North Americans can do to advance the human rights and nation-building struggle in Palestine, Israel. You mentioned some of the organizations that people might work with, like Boycott, Divest, Sanction. I think that's extremely important. If it takes hold, it could well have significant impacts, as it did in South Africa, which is the only reason that blacks have at least gotten paper citizenship. Well, great talking to you. We'll do it again. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
And that wraps up our show today. I want to thank MOLE's Bill Resnick, Luisa Martinez, and Larry Bolden, as well as their guests, Shannon Osaka, Mitch Green, and Wael Asadi, for their contributions. Thanks also to Denise Morris and John Nelson for their help in producing the show. Lastly, as always, our gratitude to the hardworking staff at KBOO, your community radio. Today, I want to leave you with a clip from a song by the 12-year-old Palestinian rapper named Abdel Rahman Al-Shanti. The video of him rapping among the ruins of Gaza went viral earlier this week. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay active.
Palestine's been occupied for decades, but a home for centuries. This land is generations of my family's memories. To plan, grow, and nurture, the symbol of peace. The olive trees guaranteed that our people could eat. Living with limitations, pushed down by the occupation. Wanna see the pain? Take a look at the people's faces. Imagine being kicked out of the only house you ever known. We're praying for our souls while they're praying on our homes. It's not easy to put this into words. Looking at my baby sister, is this something she deserves? Growing up in a world where she's not treated the same. Denied the right to live free because of where she came.